Yeah, a question about this one. There's two ways to pop up.
Right, you can use either one.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but I want the answer in degrees and minutes, so not just degrees. Get it? Okay. All right. All right, any questions? Yes.
When you were able to get rid of the arc seconds because the units were the same on the top and bottom, mm-hmm. Is that always the case?
Oh, anytime you have the similar things, top and bottom, yeah, they'll divide out and become one.
Mm-hmm. As units, okay.
Yeah. Any other questions? Lights? Okay, is anyone handing in their observation? Did anyone make an observation last night that you need to hand in? All right.
I went there on Monday, and he said there's nothing up in the sky because it's cloudy.
Okay, well, does that mean there's nothing up in the sky? Now you know.
He said it was too cloudy.
Yeah, yeah. In the case of that, you can still fill out that form and hand it in to me as cloudy, and I'll give you 99 instead of 100. But if you want, you can go to another night. You
can
actually. Okay, so then you have that option, because I know some of you, if you're working and you took the day off and then you got there and you can't take another night off until your next observation, I'll give you credit for showing up. And or if you'd like, you can reschedule. Not a problem at all. Okay, any other questions?
If I get a 99, do you go back?
Yeah, 99 shows me in there. No, you get 100.
Oh, no matter.
No, I mean, if you just handed it in, this way I'm not going to penalize you because the weather was bad.
Well, but if you go there and do the work and then something is different, it's not exactly right, you get the full 100?
No, there's no such thing as not right. You either observe or you don't. You either do the observation or you don't do it. So you do it, you get 100. Yeah. Yeah, you're looking through a telescope and you're drawing what you see. So, unless you draw a picture of Mickey Mouse when you're looking at the moon, then I would say, oh, that's interesting. Maybe there's a.
Making a new park.
But yeah, you could, I mean, that would be unusual. Okay. Prehistoric astronomy. Some of the stuff that I've encountered in my career dealing with astronomical things, some very interesting. One area that I got involved in a few years ago is something called archaeoastronomy. And essentially it deals with, you go to old sites where people have built maybe huge buildings or maybe just piled rocks one on top of the other. And you try to figure out if there's a connection between how they built this stuff and the sky. Is there some correlation? So this would be in the realm of prehistoric astronomy when you go really far back in time. Also, it could be more modern, maybe within 1,000, 2,000 years. You consider that more modern when you consider really old stuff. But the word prehistoric essentially just means before people wrote stuff down in a formal way. So there could be cultures today on this planet. There could be tribes someplace that don't have a written language, and you could say that everything they've done is prehistoric because for them, they didn't write anything down. So when we deal with some of this prehistoric, these concepts in astronomy, we're dealing with a time when people sort of wrote things down in a weird sort of way using alignments of buildings or maybe natural phenomena or natural geologic phenomena that they would use as a signpost to the sky. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the fact that all of us here today have come from a successful predecessors as far back in time as you want to imagine. So you're here today because there's an unbroken line between you and as far back in time as you can imagine. Now, of course, this poor person is not here, so there was a break in the link someplace, right? But do you get the point? Now, we normally don't think like this. We just think that everything started with us. You know, here I am and that's it. But no, you came from this unbroken line. Think of that. And of course, maybe some of us are going to continue that unbroken line and have kids and go on into the future. So we're at this point as well, which means then that our ancestors were pretty good at using some of the knowledge that we call prehistoric astronomy. And from my studies of some of this stuff, I've come up with a conclusion based on why would people even be interested in astronomy at all? What's the motivation? And my conclusion, studying many of these sites, is that what drives people would be basic things like food. You know, you want to eat. And if you want to eat, then you need to know something about where your food supply is. And either you followed your food supply, if you were a hunter-gatherer, which our ancestors were, ultimately, or you settled down and you planted your food and kept some food stuff in the form of animals close by you. And of course, all of this stuff that I'm going to give you is based on what I call Ida Vaia's naive history. So while it's good stuff, if you want to know more detail, then you need to study that and look into some of the things that I talk about. But I'll give you an overview just to give you an idea of how astronomy and humanity are interrelated and where it began. And that's what we're going to start talking about today. So if we want to look at the earliest astronomy, we're going to go back to a time, based on artifacts that we find now, which goes back quite a bit, approximately 20,000 years. So again, the unbroken line from you back in time, we're going to go back at least 20,000 years. And some of the things that we see in the form of artifacts help us understand the relationship between the motivations of our ancestors and astronomy. And what we find way back then is that there was no agriculture, as we understand agriculture. Okay. People were hunter-gatherers. They followed their food supply. Okay, essentially followed the food. So you could either follow the food in form of animals, as animals migrate from place to place, or plants, you know, berries, you know, where you should be at a certain time of the year in order to get the food that you like, the berries that you like to eat. And our ancient ancestors had a certain knowledge of celestial cycles. So now, let's see if you can tell me what some of those celestial cycles might be. Phases of the moon. All right. What else? Yes.
Seasons.
The seasons, but we want to tie this to celestial cycles.
Solstice.
Ah, so okay, so phases of the moon, solstice, so something to do with the sun. What about the sun? You see, you're so far removed from it because you don't pay attention anymore that it's so. What does the sun do every day?
It rises.
And then what does it do?
It sets.
And then when you pay attention where it's rising and setting, then you can figure out something that deals with seasons or these the solstice idea. So the rising and setting of the sun. What other things do you think our ancestors would pay attention to?
Equinox.
Yeah, I'd be dealing with the sun, but I mean in terms of an observation that you could actually make over a period of time.
The changing patterns of the stars.
Yeah, the changing patterns of the stars. Now the stars within, on the sky, the distances within that so-called pattern, that's not changing. But what patterns you see changes. You see? So, and that then again would be tied to some seasonal variations possibly. So again, We would look at different stop patterns. Now, from this, we get some interesting information. For example, all of these, when you take them on the face, relate to time. There's a passage of time because you're seeing different things occur. Now, one of the important things that our ancestors were well aware of is, especially if you're following your food supply, is when you're going to make more of you, when you're going to have babies. And which one of these three things do you think might be associated with having babies?
Phase of the moon.
Phase of the moon. And why is that? All the women know.
Women's things.
Yeah, women's things. Menstrual cycle. Now, don't use this for birth control, okay? You may be surprised. There are cycles, but because the cycle is not quite fixed, then there's a little error, it advances in time. So when you think, oh, this is okay, surprise. So, however, if that was your only method, you paid attention more so than people would today. And what I discovered looking at various cultures is that every culture that I've seen, I've studied, associates the moon with a feminine symbolism. Okay? So in all the cultures that I've seen, I haven't seen any that haven't done this, but the moon becomes associated with the female characteristics. So as a symbol, the moon is and probably related to reproduction. And of course, since we're all here and we're from a successful line unbroken to the distant past, our ancestors apparently knew about this. They knew when to have us. They knew when to plant, when they finally did. And they could tell the length of the day or the length of the night. Most cultures, and probably most of us in this room, are still afraid of the dark. I'll tell you a story. Big modern astronomer. I was working down at the Multiple Mirror Telescope on Mount Hopkins one night, and it was in December, and a big snowstorm was coming by. And at 9,000 feet, we're going to get clobbered with snow. So we shut down the observatory, turned on the heaters. There's a big steep road that goes the final distance up to the observatory so that the snow would melt and we could still get a heavy equipment up and down. And, of course, I was the last one to leave the observatory. And I had to lock everything up. So I'm inside this big building, and it's quiet. It's just me. And there's a trench along the inside, because the whole building rotated. And down in the basement is where the big wheels were, like train, looked like train car wheels, and the building would move around that. But in an observatory, there are other sounds. There are sounds of air compressors and gas being vented, because the detectors would have various systems that had to purge air to keep moisture off the detectors. So, and then the ladders that go down, like straight down, like you walk down into these pits, just like the scary horror movies, right? And the lights are low, and then there are three stories on this thing, and I'm the last one, I'll go check everything. And the storm is starting, the wind is blowing, and there's this narrow, the road, if you go off the wrong side, you'll fall 1,000 feet to the next level on the mountain. And if you go to the other side, you'll smash into the mountain. So I've got everything ready, and it's really ominous looking out, and dark, and you can just, how the clouds capture the light, in the environment. So, that's what it looked like. So I'm already there, just do something, and I'm gone. So shut the door. Lock it up, and I start walking down to the dormitory, and I start whistling, like that. And all of a sudden, I felt this thing go by my legs. And I just jumped and screamed, ah! And I looked down, and whatever went by my legs went, ah! It was the observatory cat. So much for a big, brave 20th century at the time, a knowledgeable person. Those basic things that are in our psyche are still there, and we try our best to fool ourselves, but they're still there. So our ancestors had to deal with this. If they're interested in the length of the day, then they'd be paying attention to what the sun is doing. And little by little, they discovered that if you watch the sun over a period of time, that the sun doesn't come up in the same place every day. Now, if you're a hunter-gatherer, that would not be your first primary observation or concern, because you were following the sun. So as the sun would move toward a particular direction, you continue to follow it. So for us in the northern hemisphere, we would move toward the south and just follow the sun and then turn around and go the other way. But if you stay still, you discover that the sun typically on its own seems to move toward the south or back again toward the north. And that was a great discovery. Maybe you wanted to mark something on the horizon from where you happen to live. So once you went from hunter-gatherer, you started paying attention in a different way. The various cultures would have means of reckoning time. Reckoning, something like that. There's a K in there somewhere. Where is it?
After the C.
After the C. Okay. Thank you. Reckoning time. Now, this wasn't as easy as you would think, because they didn't have watches. Okay? So their time was taken from the skies. I remember a number of years ago, I used to run this program for kids up on Mount Lemmon. And one year we got a hold of this this Cherokee Indian. His name was Willie Whitefeather. And the guy was cool. He was an author. He would write kids' books on different things, Indian. And he, 6 months out of the year, he'd go and live in a teepee someplace. And then when he had enough of that, he'd come back to civilization. So we got a hold of him, and he did this neat program with kids up on the mountain. And he was teaching the kids what to do if you got lost in the wilderness. And so one kid asked, well, how do you know what to eat? And he says, well, you do a little experiment. He says, if something looks like it's good to eat, like a plant, he said, you take the plant and you bite a little bit off and spit it out right away. And then wait a little bit and see if there's any tingling in your mouth or anything. If there's no tingling, then go ahead and bite a piece off, chew it up, and spit it out. And if there's no tingling after a while, then go ahead and eat a little bit and swallow it. And if you don't throw up and get sick, then it's probably okay to eat. And then the kid asks, well, how do you know time? You don't have a watch. How do you know how much time goes by? And he says, well, if it's night, you're lost. He says, you look at the sky, and you look at the Big Dipper. And the Big Dipper is a big clock. And you just watch as the Big Dipper moves. And you can then guess with experience that how much time passes in a small interval of time, because you don't have a watch. So it was very, very nice. And he told the kids that when you're lost, you really aren't lost. You know exactly where you are. No one else does. But so, and again, it's a different perspective on, you know, such things. And don't eat where you sleep, because you'll have friends with you at night. And nice little things. But what was interesting about his comment was time. How do you determine time if you don't have a watch? And of course, the other way is you could just stick a stick in the ground and watch a shadow pass as the sun moves ahead. You could do it when the moon is full too, and you have some sense of time passing. So again, the astronomical connection. But then how would you record these ideas? The local tribes, Tohono O'odham, have a series of, they used to use the things called calendar sticks. And calendar sticks are universal around the world in different cultures. You would take a stick, and when an event occurred, you put a mark on it. Or you would just put a mark every time you saw the sun come up. Now you say, well, that's great, except suppose you fell and hit your head. and you're unconscious for a couple of days. Now, again, this is difficult for us to imagine, because you could fall, hit your head, be unconscious for a couple of days, and in about 2 seconds, you'll know what day it is. You'll know the day you fell, you know, if you're back to your senses, and very quickly, you can look at a calendar, and you can determine how many days you are out. Well, how do you do that when you don't have this reference, you know, nice clock? All right, which one of these three things might help you?
Phases of the moon.
And you hear in the old cowboy Indian movies, many moons ago. Well, what's that all about? That's a measure of time. A moon could be one lunar phase or one lunar cycle. And as you'll discover, major phases, we'll call them, new moon, first quarter, full moon. It's about 7 days between each. So if you fell, banged your head when there was a new moon, and when you woke up you saw first quarter phase, then you would assume what we would call 7 days had passed approximately. So again, all these little hints that our ancestors knew something about and used very in a very serious way, the celestial cycles. Means of reckoning time, calendar sticks. Knots. Knots on a rope. As opposed to soap on a rope. We have knots on a rope. What's that all about? Some got very sophisticated. Some cultures, they would tie a series of knots and they would hang from the high priest's belt or whatever. And when the Spanish came in and decimated some of the local Indians in South America, one of the first things they did, unbeknownst at the moment they did it, is they killed off the very people that they needed to talk to if they wanted to understand about the culture that they were now in contact with. And the very people that they killed off in the first wave were the knot readers, the people who had the history and the time. So now, if you weren't one of these people in the culture, you didn't know how to read the knots, because we have these elaborate ceremonies, and we still do, as you passage from one set of understandings to another. And they did then as well. So if you wipe out the very people who have the history, and you didn't know it, or maybe you knew it, or whatever, for whatever reason, you just lost that connection to that culture's past. So knots on a rope were another way of determining things. And then, of course, another way would be to build monuments. Monuments that would tell a story within the monument. Now, these things could have been as simple as just piles of rocks arranged a certain way. Now, they could have been more elaborate buildings that may have had symbolism around them. A good example of a really elaborate building that's in more modern times, around 1500, is the Taj Mahal in India. And that thing has that's an interesting story. I don't know why women do this to themselves. The Shah, the whoever the guy was at the time, his last wife, as it turns out, that he was married to, was pregnant, and he went on this journey, and she followed him. All right, she got there. He thought this was wonderful. Well, she died, and her booby prize was the Taj Mahal. That's where she's buried. Okay, you know, give me the money before I kick off, right? No, this guy, he said, oh, I loved her so much. But he had all her favorite passages from the Quran put up and down that thing. So if all this writing you see, the Arabic writing, were all her favorite passages from the Quran and the Bible, because she was also Christian. And so that was that's a more elaborate sense. And the orientation of how the thing is built with the cardinal compass directions, etc. So that would be a very elaborate thing. The Egyptians and some of their structures. Okay, you go down to South America, Machu Picchu. I did some work there. And one of the interesting buildings up at Machu Picchu is called El Torreón, the tower. And it's a squat little building, and it has one window opened toward the horizon, and opposite the window, inside the structure, is a rock. And a rock, if I draw it in profile, sort of like that. It's got a high and a low piece of it. It's not a step, but it's cut like that. And during a certain day of the year when the sun would rise, go through the window, and illuminate the rock. Down in Mexico, at Monte Albán, up on the top of that mountain, there's a Monte Albán, the village that was built there with some pyramids and such. There's a building, it's called Building J, and it's shaped sort of like a point. And the point points someplace on the horizon, but on the first day of spring, when the sun rises at noon, half the building's in shadow, half the building is illuminated. So now anybody who's up in that village can immediately tell when the first day of spring is. And again, if all this is tied to agriculture, it's very important. In South America, in Peru, the entire agricultural system is based on astronomy. When I was there, I was there a couple of times doing some work with some of the locals, and what was fascinating, I went down once with a group to do some eclipse stuff, and so I got to meet some of the locals, and what was fascinating to me is how much the locals forgot about their astronomical heritage. They still go through and do all of these plantings according to certain rituals that were astronomically based, but they didn't know it. I said a couple of things that they reminded, oh, I remember my grandfather used to say that about why we would plant the corn at this certain time. And they would talk about one of the funniest things is a story. I was there at the time, literally it was winter here, so it was summer there, so just springtime. Spring in the Andes. And they have a celebration prior to their plantings where they would make this stuff called chicha. And chicha is a drink that's made locally there, but you could also buy it like in Lima and in places. You probably still buy it around here. And if you buy the real stuff that you buy commercially, it's sort of purplish color. But it's a liquor. It's not a liqueur. It's like a wine that you make out of potatoes or corn mash or whatever. But what's funny about this is that they do this because working at altitude, they do two things. They drink the chicha and they chew coca leaves from the coca tree, which is cocaine essentially. And they have a saying about that: the man who chews too many coca leaves will walk the way he will die, because they understand the ramifications of that. But at altitude, it's a good symbiotic relationship. It gets you hot going, you stop breathing more, and the altitude takes care of the excess stress, because now your heart has to go. If you're at altitude and you run around, you feel what that means. So the chicha then is connected to this. And so I wanted a sample chicha. I don't drink, but I thought, I'm in Peru, I need to sample this. So you would find a house that would have a long pole with a piñata at the end of it, and that you would know they're participating in the activity. So I'm walking around, and I look down this alley, and here's a pole. I said, I guess I'll go there. So again, you're in different places, it's different things. Like, you would never walk into somebody's house here. They'd shoot you. But there, yeah, fine. You open the door, you walk in, here's a little courtyard, a guinea pig running all over the dirt floor. You walk in to where the kitchen looks like it is, because there's something like a stove there, and then there's these three women, and one of them's got this big tub between her legs, and they're stirring it. It reminded me of like the three witches, bell, book, and candle or something, right? And here they are, they're making this thing. Big smile. I walked in, I says, un poquito chicha. You know, that's my Spanish, that's it. And they smile. They say, okay. And you know, so I gave them a quarter or something, bring this humongous thing out. So all I want to do is taste it, right? So I tasted it. So I tasted chicha. So I got back with the people that were involved with the rest of this thing. This was a time in Peru when the Shining Path guys were running around, you know, shooting everybody. And so we had actual, a federale was armed in the group, and he was in plain clothes. So that was him, and there was this old guy. At the time, I was a lot younger, so it was an old guy, right? And this guy was smoke like a chimney, but he'd go up and down these mountains like it was nothing. So they're sitting in this little, the equivalent of a bar, but it was like this little cutout out of a rock, you know? And they had a picture of the Pope up there, and they're sitting there, and they said to me, so did you find the chicha? And I says, yeah, I found it. How was it? And they start laughing. And I'm saying, well, it was all right, you know, it's sort of fruity tasting, and it was all right. And they laughed. I said, why are you laughing? And they said, you know how they make that? I says, yeah. They take the corn, they do it and make like a corn mash, and it ferments fast. I says, yeah, but you know what helps the fermentation process? I said, well, what? You know? I said, they spit in it. So that's chicha. That's my chicha story. So what do? They run up and down the mountains. They plant according to the seasonal variations that they pay attention to. For the Quechua Indians in South America, one of the things they look for, just like the Tohono O'odham here, are the Pleiades, the seven sisters. That was their big thing when their cycle of agriculture would start. And tied into this, they would have various rituals. They would plant at certain altitudes at certain times during the cycle. One of the other things which was interesting, the Quechua word for the Pleiades is colca. Colca is also the word they use for storehouse, where the food is stored. And what was fascinating about this, to see the connection that they even missed the significance of because it was lost through time. One of the villages I was in, they had two colca. Now, these colca, you've probably seen pictures of the Andes and the way they farm, step farming, because of the terrain very steep. And the colca would be put up along sides of, in this case, the village was in a shallow valley, and the colca on either side. And these colca were built very high, very steeply, so that you could hardly get into it. They didn't want the rats going in and eat their food. So what was interesting is on the first day of spring, when again they start the cycle, when the sun came up, the western colca was illuminated by the rising sun. And when the sun set, the eastern colca was illuminated, as if to let everyone in the village know, you know, it's the time of the year when we're going to start doing some agricultural stuff. So very fascinating to see the connection in a real way between astronomy and the language and the ability for these people to start an agricultural calendar. And this, again, is one of the reasons why I say our ancestors used astronomy to deal with a calendar, which was then attached to agriculture, ultimately, or if we still followed our food supply, when you would head north or south to follow your food. During this, again, Aitavaya's naive history, okay, just a disclaimer. But you could look at this in more detail, of course. Calendar refinements. These occurred when people settled down, when our ancestors got sick and tired of following our food and said, there's got to be a better way. And so any time around here we go, say, 2,000, 10,000 to 3,000 B.C. I guess the more politically correct is B.C.E., but before Common Era, so however you're happy with, you use the term. And approximately 10,000 years ago, an interesting phenomena happened, and we have the domestication of animals and cultivation of crops. So now our food supply is going to stay put. And again, why I say this is Aitavaya's naive history is there wasn't a day 10,000 years ago when someone said, aha, I think I will domesticate animals, or now I'm going to grow tomatoes. That's not how it worked. It was a progression. But when you look at the artifacts that archaeologists discover, and you find, and you date these things, you find that all of a sudden there's this change that has occurred, and it's gradual, but at one point people just started saying, well, let's sit still. So you got domestication of animals and the beginnings of agriculture, or cultivation of crops. Probably the first crops that were cultivated were based on what we would call weeds today. You know, why not? They're growing already. They taste pretty good. You know, don't have to do much work because they're already growing. Then the plants figure it out, and then they change, and now you still have weeds again. Tomatoes were weeds. I remember as a boy, my grandparents, they would love people with lawns that had weeds in it. All right, dandelions. Dandelions are good to eat. We used to call it giardia. That's the Italian word for dandelion salad, or giardia. And so you would see all the old timers go out and they'd see the giardia in the people's nice lawns and they'd pick it up and take it. And of course you can make dandelion wine and all sorts of things. But it was good. It had a lot of iron in it. Anyway, you had this this occurrence. When this happened, then you had calendar refinements. Because now people were stationary. They were in one place. They could pay attention to what was happening with the celestial cycles with reference to the horizon. And now you could see, if you paid attention every day when the sun would rise, you would see that it moved from place to place over the course of a period of time. And if you marked the important points, maybe references, like when the days will start getting shorter, when they'll start getting longer, then those became important. The two walls I have out here at the observatory mark two of those points. They mark the equinoxes and they mark the solstice. All right, just to give you an idea. They wouldn't have built anything elaborate like that. They probably would have had piles of stones, but eventually they would. They would build entire structures that would line up to those things, or maybe windows along the structures. Casa Grande, up the road here, there's a building, Casa Grande, right? And it does have aligned buildings. The buildings itself, the windows in the big one, the big house there, it is aligned to where the sun rises on my March 21st, again, would be agriculturally significant. So, when this happened, it became important to read the sky, more so than when we were hunter-gatherers. And probably an interesting phenomenon occurred. We started to differentiate who did what in our little tribes. So we probably would then designate certain people to be the sky watchers, the ones who would read the sky, the ones whose job it was to determine where we were in the celestial cycle, ultimately the agricultural cycle. They would be the ones that would tell the ones who would be responsible for planting, say, when it was time to plant. This was a very important job. It was so important that if you got it wrong, you didn't have the job anymore. Right, because everybody's life depended on you. So this probably worked in a very weird way. Here we have a person who is designated as the official sky watcher, which has a very important job to tell people when to plant. And the person who now has his job figures, you know, maybe I could take advantage of this. And eventually these people became the high priests. And then they got all this adulation heaped upon them and great importance, more than they had. And these people then might say, if they weren't very ethical, you know, maybe I can control this entire population by making pronouncements of one thing or another. And ultimately it turns into what we have today, somewhere along the line, where you get in the form of the high priests and the equivalents of that in form of religious activities. But then again, you would say, wait a minute, of course, these people are connected to the sky. You see, so they do know what they're talking about. And maybe not. But who's going to be the one to say no? In Peru, they have these posts. They're called the Intihuatana stones. And Inti is the Quechua word for sun. Okay, and Watana essentially means the hitching post. The hitching post of the sun. And what happens here during the course of a year, they of course know that the sun is heading closer and closer to the horizon. Days are getting shorter and shorter. So they have a special feast at winter. And the feast essentially, figuratively, is to lasso the sun with this this rope and then attach it to the hitching post, the Intihuatana zone. And if everybody was good and did what they were supposed to and didn't piss anybody off, the sun would then start to rise back up again. Okay? Now think about this. Here's a society that's built on this concept. And then you're somebody in that society like me who's got to question everything, right? And so I say to the chief guys, I say, wait a minute. Let's do an experiment. Let's not have this feast and see what happens to the sun. Okay? And they look at me and they cough my head because that's it. You don't want this word spreading around. But the fact is, if you did the experiment, the sun's still coming up. And they knew it too. But the thing is, once you establish certain control, then why go with it? Who is going to question anything that would say your questioning itself is going to change something for the worse? You see? So, but today people are afraid to question, or people don't want questions who should be having questions, right? And the result is the same effect. So here we have the Egyptians looking at a similar problem. And we look at Egypt, and we take some... Now, I'm going to use this example because it is probably the closest thing to having something written in stone. All right? The Egyptian Book of the Dead goes through a very elaborate explanation of the process of mummification and all that it implied, why they did this and how they did it, and the connection to the sky in terms of certain things. Well, part of the Egyptian cosmology, and again, here's the calendrical aspect of watching the sky, dealt with the star Sirius. So, and you'll be seeing Sirius in the nights to come as the days get shorter and Orion starts to rise and Sirius is there. The idea about Sirius is the following. They associated, Sirius was associated with the flooding of the Nile. So why is this a big deal? Well, if you're familiar with what it looks like in that part of the world, the Nile flows into the Mediterranean, but as all rivers do, there's a delta. The Mississippi, there's a delta in the Mississippi. You don't want to live in the delta of a river because it floods there. And yet people still build cities in deltas, right? And then it floods and everybody cries. But the thing is, we know you don't build in a floodplain, okay? You're taking a big chance. All right. So why is this important? Well, if you're farming along a river, you're waiting for the flood to come yearly because the flood, in the process of taking all that water along, also carries nutrients that sort of recharges the soil that you're going to plant in. So if you plant after the flood, you got nice rich soil to grow your crops in. And then you get the crops out before the next time you have a flood and things are cool. So what someone managed to notice, and again, I make it sound like somebody got up one night and noticed this, right? Say, oh, look at that. The star Sirius rose. Now, there's a special name for these observations, and it's called heliacal rising or heliacal setting. And I'll give you the definition for that in a bit. But essentially it means there's going to be one special day when if you're looking toward the east, you're going to see a star rise just before the sun rises. The next day, it's above the sunlight, essentially, so you'll see it in the sky very easily. The day before, it was still in the glare of the sun, you couldn't see it. So it's a precise way of finding a day when something can start. So what they would do is they'd see the star rise, heliacally rise, and that day they'd start counting, and so many days later, the Nile would flood. And then after the flooding, then they could plant and take care of the farming. So they were really making the connection that every time Sirius rose heliacally, the Nile floods. As if to say, the rising of Sirius controlled the flooding of the Nile. So now, what experiment could you possibly do to see if that were true or not? Well, you can't stop Sirius from rising. So maybe you could stop the Nile from flooding, and that should stop Sirius from rising, right? If they're connected? Well, a couple of thousand years ago, you didn't have any option on that. I don't know, within the last 40 years or so, they happened to build a dam at Aswan, which stops the Nile from flooding. But guess what? Sirius still heliacally rises, and the Nile will flood after that as far as it can get to the dam. And so now all the farmers that live down at the dam, they have to truck fertilizer in when they used to get it for free. But the thing is, that's the experiment. It was done, and there is no connection. However, during this time period, our ancestors started seeing connections between celestial activity and terrestrial activity. And they started making maybe not the right connections or the right attachments to these two things. They would incorrectly think that one was affecting the other. And ultimately, as we'll see, that turned into an interesting bunch of knowledge that people built on. You go to northern climates. Northern climes. Oh, that's a nice... Essentially, where it's always cloudy and the sun hardly shines, and you make a rather interesting discovery. You don't have this rich lore of the sky that more drier places had, southwest here and desert regions. It seems that the people with the most interesting sky stories lived where it was dry and the sun and the sky was clear most of the time. But what about the northern climate? So suppose some of you from Scandinavia and such, did they have some equivalent things? And they did. And one of the biggest things would be during the winter months when the days were getting shorter. They would have great festivals and they'd have bonfires trying to keep the sun back, the light back. And again, people knew that there's really no connection, but you're not going to be the one to say it, right? Because then you're in trouble. And it still happens. If you tell the emperor he doesn't have any clothes, right? You ever hear that and read that story? The emperor's new clothes? So, while there's this connection, there's also a tendency to be superstitious and to make connections between celestial activity and terrestrial activity that while on the surface they seem to be connected, and if they are connected, they weren't for the reasons people thought. Right? Don't walk on a crack, break your mother's back. Stuff like that started to come out. Right? And of course, when you were a kid, you probably liked your mother and you didn't want to break her back, so you didn't step on a crack once you heard that. Or maybe you were mad at your mother and you stepped on a crack and then your mother might have fallen and got hurt and then you felt bad and then you figured, oh, I did it because I stepped on a crack, right? Or then you stepped on a crack and nothing happened and so then you finally figured out that there's no connection. And if there is, it's going to be some kind of a connection that deals with some sort of a coincidence. But who knows? And then if you're one of these people that have some compulsive behavior, you can't even walk where there are cracks because you got to step all crazy ways. And so you just sit down and wait for the bus to come pick you up instead of go find the bus. But all of these things were intertwined in our ancestors' worldview. Now, it's difficult sometimes to try to figure out what was going on in the minds of ancient people. But some things we can figure out, right? We have in common with these people. We have the sky. And the reaction to the sky that we have today is probably the same that our ancestors had. Just one of awe and mystery. Just causes you to look at it and wonder what's going on out there. And I bet everybody in this room, at some point, when you looked out at the sky, you sort of get mellow. Even if it's for a minute or a second, you get mellow because all of a sudden you're overwhelmed by what's out there. You see? So no matter what language, what your culture, that's something we all share on this planet. And people did similar things, even though the outcome's not exactly the same. They used the sky as some sort of a model to explain things. Every culture would have patterns that they'd recognize as certain important things to their culture. Now, we're all familiar with what the Greeks looked at in terms of the constellations and the names we have. But yet the star names are Arabic. So there's a blending of cultures, even in how we describe the stars over our heads. And this is fascinating when you look at it. Of course, if you're too parochial in your thinking, you think that all the constellations have these names and that's it. And then if someone says, oh, no, the Egyptians called the Big Dipper this. And now with your stellarium program, you can actually change the sky law and see what different cultures cause different or call different things. So again, a nice use for that program to get you out of that box thinking that there's only one way to look at stuff. However, what would be interesting is maybe research the actual names that they gave to certain constellations to see if there's some underlying connection. Because when we talk about constellations, maybe there is. Maybe, again, there was this even grander scheme of things in terms of naming constellations that would still go back to the idea of agriculture. All right, and again, this is my thesis, that people were motivated by the sky for this very reason. Okay. The year. Oh, what a mess when we try to deal with time. I'm on this listserv, History of Science, and there's a lot of stuff that comes through on from historians that deal with astronomical things and try to figure out, you know, you say, oh yeah, the thing is a year long, or it started on this day. And then the question is, what day? What do you mean day? When does the day start? Does it start when the sun comes up? Does it start when the sun sets? Does it start when the sun reaches midway at noon, a local noon? When does the day begin? And you end up with all these different variations. And you say, today, we don't have that problem. Well, yeah, look at time zones. And you say, well, what a big deal. So you're 15 degrees along the earth and you change it by an hour. Well, you go into the Middle East and they've got half-hour time zones. What's a half-hour time zone? Well, you can make whatever you want when you're the boss, right? So, but then, if you're going to live with the rest of the world, you're going to have some way of doing the conversions. So MTV doesn't have a problem doing that. In Saudi Arabia, MTV will start, you know, on a half hour, 45 minutes, and then next door it starts on a half hour, I don't know. But crazy stuff like that. But the year, let's see if there's some astronomical observations, some celestial cycle, to help us come up with at least a day count for the year. If you're going to count the days, that would give you from where the sun is to where the sun gets back to that very point, how many days would that take? And how is it that it comes out that amount of days? Now, if I said to you right now, in modern times, how long is the year in days, you would say 365. See, then there's an extra one thrown in there, and every 4 years you add an extra day and all this. So those problems arise because you're trying to correlate and synchronize the civil calendar with what the sky is doing. Okay. Now, if you have a total lunar calendar, and you have a total lunar calendar, you don't care. You just follow the cycles of the moon, which then, if you're really into fundamentalism from a particular perspective, you end up with a problem because you may have holidays falling on days that they're not supposed to fall. And so immediately you start changing the calendar, so you're not a strict lunar calendar person. But if you are, then holidays aren't going to fall on the same day. They're just going to change. So, if we look at the sun rising, and if you're every day watching the sun come up on the horizon, you will notice that it slightly changes over time, okay, and ultimately ends up further south at some point and further north, and then midway between we call the equinox. Well, for 6 months I watched the sun come up just to do the experiment, because I meet so many people that talk about stuff and they've never done it. So when I made the argument that we have a 360-degree circle, I'd say it was based on sunrise over a period of a year. And they say, well, no, they would be 365. I say, I say, if you watch the sun come up, it doesn't change as fast as you think it's going to change. And why is that? What's the resolution of our eyes? 120 arc seconds. How big is the sun? 1800 arc seconds. The sun can move its diameter, you wouldn't see it. See? It'd take a while before you notice that the sun moved its diameter. And that might be just enough to account for those extra 5 days, if you were precisely looking at the center of the sun move versus the diameter of the sun move. So I looked at the sunrise for half a year, just for fun. And I didn't notice the sun move as fast as I thought it would move. Okay? And I marked, I took a photograph. And so then I got pictures of where the sun's moving along the horizon. And so I postulated that, yeah, the year must be based on a cycle, a complete circle, right? When it begins, when it ends. And it's based on 360 days. So a cycle is based on 360 days or 360 degrees. And that's where that probably came from. So a year is based on sunrise or set, depending on who's doing the counting. Now, of course, we have our calendar. For most of the world, the civil calendars would be based on solar activity. Okay, and of course, there are religious calendars that are based on lunar activity, and all the religions that you probably are familiar with or heard of have calendars based on the lunar cycle. Okay. And the question is, why they do that? I don't know. But maybe the moon, because of its shorter, its phases, right? You have shorter intervals of time you can block out for holidays. I mean, the sun, you have three major points in its thing, four major points. Furthest north, due east, and furthest south, and then back due east again, right, on rising. So maybe you can have special days, you only have four of them. But if you have the moon, well, every month you have four. So you got like 48 special days in the course of a civil year if it's based on the sun. Maybe that's it. More control, right? You can have more, or more past the basket, whatever. So the year is based on sunrise or sunset. The 360 degree circle, I think, this is me now, so you can blame me if someone says anything, I think, is based on the rising of the sun from one horizon position, depending upon which you pick, to that same position. So you'd pick an extreme position, maybe the furthest north, and then count days from that time back again and come up with this value. And of course, the other problem, or the other reason this might be, is not so much your observation along the horizon, but the path the sun seems to take. It changes seasonally. Sometimes the sun comes up very steeply, and sometimes it seems to come up almost vertical, depending upon the time of year. So that would also affect the time and what you're seeing rise. So this is something that I think makes some sense, and no one has told me anything differently, so that's the advantage of saying stuff. Nobody picks on you. But when you talk to people, they'll just say, that doesn't make any sense. Welcome to basic astronomy. Yeah, like what makes astronomy different from astrology? Lots and lots of math. and all the students disappear. This is not true.
No.
There's a huge amount of math in astrology, okay? So I put that so you laugh because the students left. But when you do astrology, there's a lot of math involved. And as we're going to see eventually, the actual calculation end of astronomy was based in astrology, wanting to know where different things would occur. So our ancestors, when they paid attention to what was going on the horizon and where things would rise, and again, that there were certain celestial events that occurred and seemed to cause certain terrestrial events, what would happen here is they would start making these connections that were not true. Okay, do you have any questions? I'm done for today. Now, what I'd like to do is talk to you about the lab activity, lab one, right? So let me get what you need for that.